One of which will be a reading by one of Wallace's own, and that's Heather Brandstetter, a native of Wallace. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
Let's find out who you are. Did you grow up in town?
I grew up in Osborne, actually.
Oh, in Osborne. Okay,
yeah.
One of those many related places. And did your people, your ancestors, your family, were they part of the whole mining?
They were, yeah. That was how my family ended up in Wallace to begin with. My grandma was born in Nebraska and then her family moved back to Wallace when she was about 6 months old. And she lived in all the towns from Wallace to Burke and even Mullen while growing up. And then my grandpa came out to work in the mill there.
And so you were born in Wallace?
I was born in Silverton.
Well, but in the, yeah, born and grew up there. So you've lived in Wallace through all kinds of times, including the, what, 76, or when was the horrible, mine, was it in the 70s?
Yeah, the mine disaster. Yeah. I believe it was 72.
Yeah. There you go, or I don't know.
I wasn't born yet.
Oh, you weren't born yet. Okay, well, sorry about that.
I
assume everybody's as old as I am. But still, talk about what kind of a place it is which depends on something like mining for its commerce, the ups and downs, the difficulties. How does that create a community?
Well, I definitely remember when I was about 9 or 10 or so, lots of my friends moved away because their miner fathers were going to Nevada or elsewhere to find work.
Because that's when things were really closing down.
Yeah, a lot of the mines ended up shutting down right then, and that's right around the time that the cat house was shut down too. It seemed like the economy for the rest of the nation was doing pretty good at the time, but for the Silver Valley, it was kind of crashing.
Sure. So it was kind of a depressed area.
Yeah. In my childhood, it was. Mm-hmm. But, right before I was born, when my parents moved there, they had to actually move over to Pritchard. That's where I spent the first 3 years of my life because they couldn't find a house in the area. Mm-hmm. So times changed rather quickly. Mm-hmm.
Part of that's because the canyon's so steep, there are not many places to put houses to.
Yeah.
But you grew up there with that kind of a place and with the difficult economy. Did that give you a feeling you needed to get out of there, go to college, and pursue a life elsewhere?
There was definitely the attitude that if you could get out, that you should.
So did you?
Yes.
So describe your journey out.
Well, at first I went to University of Idaho, mm-hmm. and I did my undergrad there.
In what?
English and philosophy. And I was going to be a lawyer, but then I sat down to take the LSAT, and I decided that I didn't want to jump through that hoop, so I probably didn't want to really be a lawyer. And I started taking more creative writing classes and decided I'd go to grad school in literature. I ended up in North Carolina because it was one of the best public schools in the nation for English. Literature in particular, but what I found out when I got there was that the study of writing itself, and especially connected to the tradition of rhetoric, was very good at North Carolina for that specialty. And so I switched over to that, and I pursued a career as a professor for a while until finally I decided that this book that I'd been working on for the last five years, needed to really get done. And so I moved back to Wallace to try and finish it and focus my energy on it.
So you have no day job. You're living on a wing and a prayer and a book that's just out.
Yeah, well, I decided that I'd figure out what I was going to do when I got back. And I ended up working in the school district. And, I mean, it was kind of hard to get by. I will be starting a new job this fall as a counselor for Mullen School District. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of staying involved in the schools.
Heather Brandstetter, who is my guest here, who has written a book about what everybody just knows is the most famous image of Wallace, the title of your book, Selling Sex in the Silver Valley. And I think what's even better than that, it has a subtitle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's called A Business Doing Pleasure. And I actually wanted that subtitle to be the main title, mm-hmm. but the press thought that it would probably sell better if we reversed it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that people instantly would know. So first talk about that sense of of growing up in that town famous for its whorehouses, was that kind of an embarrassment ever to you? Or when you went to Moscow, the University of Idaho, did people kind of point left, oh, you're from Wallace, what goes on there?
Yeah, that definitely happened in Moscow. I think growing up, I didn't really realize it was very unusual. We just kind of, you know, we gossiped about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. We knew there was something kind of, you know, scandalous going on, but it wasn't something that we imagined to be out of the ordinary until we got a little older.
Mm-hmm. So then why did you get serious and, like you say, spend 7 years of your life working on this book?
Well, originally I was kind of thinking about doing it for a dissertation project. In the field of rhetoric, there's a subfield that's pretty well developed. It's called historiography. It's the how history gets made, how and why, and the persuasive matters that are involved in it. So I was sort of interested in how the cat houses in Wallace had lasted for so long through the years. And I realized that I didn't actually know very much about them. And I went into the Mining Museum in Wallace and I asked what kind of information they had. And the Mining Museum director at the time, Jim McReynolds, said they didn't have any information, really. And that was a shame because that was a thing that many people, maybe even most people, wanted to know about when they came in. And so that seemed like a pretty obvious need. And my dissertation director sort of discouraged me from doing a project that was so far away and ambitious. You know, they didn't think there'd be any materials there. And in fact, there were tons of materials, but I had to really dig around to find them. I found some master's thesis that were pretty helpful. And then I found some old oral histories. And then I decided to embark on interviewing people myself and talked with 99 different individuals for the project to get their stories.
Because it was recent enough that you could find plenty of people to talk with.
Yes, yeah. And so it turned out that a lot of my post-World War II information came from oral histories. Mm-hmm. And whereas I relied more on just kind of scraps of whatever I could find that was in the written record for before that, with the exception of some oral histories that had been taken in 1979 and they'd been written out and they went all the way back into like the Prohibition era. Mm-hmm.
Well, the women who worked in the you call them cat houses, is that the easy enough universal term here?
It's probably the most often used word. Sometimes people just call them the houses. But
were they part of Wallace civilization? Were there two parallel civilizations that didn't meet, or did they go to church on Sunday and play with the neighbor's kids on Monday morning or anything like that? What did you know about them as part or not part of the civilization there?
Right. The relationship was pretty complex, actually. They lots of the women were integrated into the town life. Some of them were married to miners and even became a part of town. While, on the other hand, the perception was necessary that there was a space in between the town and community life and what happened in the houses. So the women weren't supposed to solicit around town, and they were, you know, more or less not supposed to hang out at the bars and that kind of thing. So there was a perception of distance there. And in some ways, that distance was real. But they also did participate in the life of the community, and they did a lot as far as monetary contributions. And everybody, it seems like everybody has a story to tell how they were connected to some of the women in the houses, whether that was that they did their hair or they took care of their, you know, beauty needs or transportation needs or banking or, you know, Western Union, that kind of thing. Or there were doctors who gave them checkups as well. So the women were definitely a part of the life in the town, and they were a big part of the economic life of the town.
Well, yeah, and is that the simple explanation of why it went on so long, why it was tolerated, why prudery or other factors didn't close it down because it was just too essential economically?
It was in part definitely the economics. my argument that I make in the book is that the women made themselves a part of the identity of the town itself. So the idea is that mining town needs whorehouses, needs brothels. There's people who, you know, pretty much everyone who I talk to would say stuff like, the women kept rapes down. The women were clean and, you know, they didn't spread diseases. And they, even some people said they kept families together, which was kind of a surprising argument to me. And so they also said, you know, the economic argument of they gave a lot back to the community. But it seems like the biggest thing was that it was a part of mining town life was you have to have brothels. And the women made that argument effectively through small talk around town.
The feeling about prostitution within a city, within Spokane, is going to be several things. In modern life, too, that there's a big drug implication, that the women are trapped into it as the only way that they themselves are unfortunate. That's the only way they can keep going. And then especially the issue of pimps and the fact that they're part of a larger crime machine. Could you say that prostitution in Wallace over that period was free of almost everything I just said?
Well, lots of the women did have pimps, and they weren't from the Silver Valley either, and so they were coming into town from elsewhere, where prostitution did exist in a different way. The thing that made Wallace a little more positive situation than a lot of places was not only that it was women owned and operated, which makes a difference, and helped make it so that the women who worked in the houses were protected in different ways from when men are in charge. But it was also regulated, and even though it was illegal, it was out in the open and accepted in this kind of pragmatic way. So the women were going to the sheriff's department and getting their pictures taken and getting background checks and getting fingerprinted, kind of similar to what you might do if you're going to work in a school. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting contradiction there. It was also not under the table. It was all very out in the open that the women were, you know, giving money to the sheriff's office. They were giving money to the school district.
And that wasn't a kickback. That was an honest expression of gift.
Yeah, they tracked it all. And in fact, that's been the argument in favor of the houses remaining open through the years, even as an illegal kind of way is, like, these women are paying taxes, and it's not going into someone's pocket. It's going back directly into the community, just like any other business would be. So that was something that made that was different in Wallace than in other places where, you know, like, corruption might be happening because it's all very in the shadows. And this is an argument that sex workers make for bringing the profession into a decriminalized state, is they say that would be best for everyone, because it would make it so that, you know, we could actually operate with it out in the open and then better, you know, regulate what happens.
Well, simply admitting the most famous phrase, the world's oldest profession.
Yeah, I mean, people in Wallace realized that it was probably going to be happening anyway, and so they decided, well, let's do this in a pragmatic sort of way. And that attitude persisted through the years, even as it changed in other areas.
And you've spent a long time researching this book, had plenty of time to experience all sides of these questions. Have your own attitudes been changed or modified by all this research and all this writing?
Yeah. Well, when I went into the research, I didn't really have an opinion one way or another on, you know, the goodness or badness of sex work, I guess. And I mean, maybe that sounds like hard to believe, but I didn't. No, I was pretty open-minded and didn't really know how I felt about it. And then through the research, through reading a lot about what the sex worker rights movement has to say, I've been persuaded that it would be important to decriminalize. Sex workers generally seem to talk about New Zealand as being an ideal model. And Wallace wasn't ideal in some ways, you know, but the spatial sequestration kind of, you know, you got to stay in your little place. That part, I think, wasn't as very positive. The fact that many of them did come, were recruited into the business by pimps and did experience abuse when they, you know, went to other places and sent money, you know, elsewhere. But I think that it kind of showed me how it might be possible to have a more positive understanding of the reality of sex work.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Heather Brandstetter, who has written this book, Selling Sex in the Silver Valley, A Business Doing Pleasure. And this Saturday is Wallace Founders Day, and you're going to be, what, doing a book signing, giving a speech? What are you doing on Wallace Founders Day?
Yes, I'm going to be doing a book talk with several other authors, including Suzanne Bimonte, Tony Bimonte, and Keith Denton. Deaton, I guess. I don't know him. Sorry. and then someone's going to be playing Colonel Wallace in the gazebo. We're going to have a big party and a parade, and it's just going to be a really huge event. From about noon onward, the parade starts at 1:00.
So it's so that's Wallace Founders Day, and so including Heather as part of that, because obviously what you have done is one aspect of history, but there's oh so much history to be talked about in the Silver Valley.
Yeah, and Wallace has really had a spotlight on it lately. It seems, you know, my book is one among others that are coming out right now. Tony Bimonte has 2 out right now. Pretty recently.
Yeah, he's been a pretty tireless historian of these things. So my guest, Heather Brandstetter, and her book, which will be there. I assume, does Andy's have them?
They did last I checked. Yeah, so they, and the Well-Read Moose in Coeur d'Alene as well.
How long's the book been out?
It came out May 15.
Oh, it's just out.
Yeah, it sold out immediately. It was nice. Kind of amazing. The first printing was 900 books, and they were gone before the release date was even
nice.
A thing.
Self-published?
No, it's published by the History Press, and they are the largest publisher of local and regional history in the nation, but they focus on local and regional history. So it's not like a nationwide marketing campaign that they usually engage in.
Well, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Heather Brandstetter from Wallace.